September 11th, 2009, the Norris Group returns with its award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate 2009. For this critical final quarter, the Norris Group has assembled a gold panel of accomplished industry specialists to discuss the impact of seismic economic shifts, head-scratching regulations, challenging legislation, and the accelerated pace of opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. 100% of the proceeds for this unique event support the Orange County affiliate of Susan G. Komen for The Cure. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshop and President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronskiest, Invest Club for Women and Director Iris Veneration, Fry Wiles, the creative agency responsible for iSurvive2009.com, J.K. Short Sales and Kathy Vanceline, Entrust California and Hugh Bromaw, the Nixon Library, MVT Productions, who always provide the audio-visual needs, the Business Press, airing the event live over the Internet, and White House Catering, who will provide the three-course meal for this black tie event. Visit iSurvive2009.com for more details.
Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest is Rick Sharga. He's the Senior Vice President of Realty Tract. Rick joined Realty Tract in 2004 as the Vice President of Marketing. He's responsible for building and maintaining the Realty Tract brand, corporate positioning and messaging, public and investor relationships, and marketing communication activities. Rick, you're interviewed almost every day somewhere. Welcome to our show.
Thanks, Bruce. Always good to be here.
What are some of the services Realty Tract offers to real estate investors?
Well, we publish the largest database of foreclosure and bank-owned properties in the country. So beyond the fact that there are currently 1.8 million of those properties in the database, we also put an awful lot of related information alongside those properties, property characteristic information, lien and loan history so people can see how encumbered the properties are, comparable sales, an interactive mapping feature that lets you see what other activity is going on in the vicinity that you're looking for. So it's basically almost a one-stop shop for people that know what they're looking to do in terms of investing in real estate, particularly foreclosures.
You know, it really used to take a lot longer, and you used to have to have a lot more expertise to get into the investing business, and Realty Tract has made it a lot easier to get to, you know, round second and head into third without an awful lot of expertise. So it is a tremendous service.
I appreciate that. And we realize that you know, using your baseball analogy a little bit further, in order to get home, there's still things you have to do offline. And that's where investors need to educate themselves and figure out what those last steps are. Just as long as we're tossing ball mots back and forth, I have to say that you guys provide some of the best educational services we've come across anywhere in the country in terms of helping investors, you know, go that last mile. So, you know, congratulations to you on your success as well.
I appreciate that. Realty Tract also offers services to other professionals. Let's talk a little bit about maybe for realtors or appraisers.
Yeah, realtors use our site really one of two or three ways. There are some agents who are looking to work with distressed homebuyers or homeowners, rather, who would prefer to do something other than lose their house to foreclosure. So we have agents that subscribe, and they'll get up to date on foreclosure activity in their neighborhoods. There are others who use our site to actually post their properties for sale, because we get about 3 million buyers a month coming to visit the site looking to purchase these properties. And then still other agents are looking to work with buyers, and so they'll advertise their services on our site to attract those buyers. Appraisers will use the site very much like investors will, in that they'll take a look at individual properties, determine market characteristics surrounding that property, and help use that to formulate market valuations on a current basis.
Right. One of the great tools that you have is taking a look at the future inventory, where they're in the NOD stage or the trustee sale stage. And as an appraiser, one of the things they have to do now is project a little into the future and see the market a few months out, and that's a big help.
If you have an REO property as a bank, and your appraiser comes back to you and says, by the way, there are 14 properties in the neighborhood that are scheduled to go to auction within the next 2 weeks, it kind of gives you an idea of what's coming. Realtors use that mapping feature as well to prepare broker price opinions and also to discuss short sale pricing. And it's funny, it's a feature we actually created for investors, and lo and behold, a lot of other professionals are finding it equally and sometimes even more useful.
How far back does RealtyTrack's data go for, let's say, the foreclosure counts?
We started publishing a monthly U.S. foreclosure report back in January of 2005, which was about a year before this current wave hit. We have data that goes back earlier than that, but reliably nationally, that's pretty far, as far back as we go.
Okay, so 1.8 million obviously is a record. It probably would be a record if you went back to year two, zero.
Well, to put it in perspective, the first full year that we tracked foreclosure activity, 2005, about 530,000 U.S. households received a foreclosure notice over the course of the year. We've had over 1.5 million households receive a foreclosure notice through the first half of this year. So the growth in foreclosure activity has been nothing short of mind-numbing over the last 4 years.
Historically, this certainly feels like the worst real estate downturn ever, and I know the data isn't as old as it would need to be, but in your sense in talking to the industry, do they feel that this is the worst downturn anyone's ever experienced?
Outside of the Great Depression, perhaps.
Yes, yeah.
Nobody says they've experienced anything like this before, both in the depth and also the rapidity with which this downturn hit. And I think even seasoned real estate industry veterans who knew there was a downturn coming were stunned by how deep and how sudden the downturn really hit.
This time, what is also accompanying a large increase in foreclosures is a crashing of prices.
Yes.
So how does a crashing of price really affect what's going to go on in the future? Because it seems like when people start now falling behind, their exits are almost none.
Well, their exits are very different than in the past. I mean, we've grown up in a culture where we were taught to honor our contracts. And now we're looking at a situation where your family's financial well-being might dictate that you walk away from a mortgage contract that you have because you're suddenly 50% upside down on your loan. In a lot of cases, the only real viable option is to try and execute a deed in lieu of foreclosure with the lender, because otherwise you're looking at possibly taking the next 15 to 20 years to get to a break-even point on this this home you've invested in. And it's a real problem for people who bought at the peak of the market on overvalued properties.
Is it becoming more acceptable to just willingly walk away, where you just go, you know what, this no longer makes sense. I have a perfectly affordable payment, but I just don't want to.
I think foreclosures have become such a part of the common vernacular today.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That there's a little bit less of a stigma associated with them than there used to be. I don't think anybody's walking around with a shirt that says, kiss me, I got foreclosed on. But it's not quite as traumatic, perhaps, as it might have been some years ago, a little bit more acceptable. And in fact, there's a lot of discussion in the industry, the lending industry, about what amounts to a sort of forgiveness program for people that have gone through foreclosure during this period, because all of the lending practices contributed to making the situation much worse than it might have been otherwise.
I think, you know what, I think that might actually make sense, because you're not going to create households fast enough to solve the problem. But if you could say to the household that lost their home a year or two ago, okay, this is the only credit negative event you've ever had,
right,
and we understand why, okay, you can join the party and buy something.
Yeah, so a lot of discussion about whether the forgiveness period shrinks from its normal 5 to 7 years down to maybe 2 or 3, or if you put special terms in place or something. But not completely altruistic, as you just pointed out. You're essentially otherwise wiping out an entire tranche of prospective home buyers.
Yes.
And we don't build them that fast. So it the home buyers, not the homes.
Right.
So that is a problem. But the other thing that kind of goes to what we're talking about is, how very different this cycle has been from day one. Usually, you have an economic event that leads to unemployment, that leads to foreclosures. This time, the foreclosure market started when we were at historically low levels of unemployment and the economy was growing at 4%.
And the interest rates were cheaper.
They were virtually they were a non-issue. They were so low.
Right, 40-year low.
Low as well. And when this started, it was because home prices, and you've tracked this but probably better than anybody, but home prices had risen to levels that were simply unsustainable. And the only way people could get into them was with these toxic loans that turned out to be ticking time bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's subsequently led to an economic fallout, and we're seeing unemployment-driven foreclosures now that are harder to solve because people have no income. And there's a third wave lined up for as soon as the unemployment problems right themselves, which is the option arm loans that were on probably the most expensive of the overvalued homes.
Right.
And quite possibly went to the least qualified of the buyers. So, I mean, back-to-back-to-back waves of foreclosure activity, and we've never seen anything like that before.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those two topics you just brought up. One of the things about unemployment, it forces a selling decision that didn't exist before.
Right.
So all of a sudden, you were probably sitting on the sidelines saying, okay, well, I'm glad I don't have to sell because I couldn't sell for what I owe. And then all of a sudden, you lose a job and you can't make a payment. And now you're a participant in something that you had no idea was coming.
And you're selling at the absolute nadir of the market in terms of home values.
Right.
So a really bad place to be.
On the option arms, those resets are going to be coming fast and heavy for the next 24 months, and they've already experienced this huge price hit. So the subprime, if it created the price decline, it wasn't so gradual, but it was if it was 3 or 4% a month when you had a reset in January, you had a whole lot more flexibility maybe than the guy had when he reset in December.
Mm-hmm.
These option arms, when they reset in Riverside, I would say 100% of them have to be upside down.
Yeah, I mean, the early resets, the ones that are recasting now, are doing so because the borrower decided to use the negative amortization option, which means they every time they make a payment, they actually owe more on the house than they did before.
Yeah.
And so some of these are triggered, and they trigger because on paper they're upside down 120, they're by about 20%. Their loan-to-value ratio is 120. And that's on paper. Reality is they've already lost 20, 30, 40% of market value from the time they were purchased. So these people are way upside down. That probably won't get much better by next year when the rest of these loans start to reset.
Mm-mm.
And to your earlier question, these homeowners have very few options. They have no equity. They have negative equity in the house. They probably can't afford the new higher mortgage payment. And even if they can, they have to question whether it's a good move for their family's financial future to keep paying now a higher rate for a property that's lost 50% of its value. So the fallout from these things is going to be pretty bad.
One of the options they may have is a loan modification. Those are becoming talked about all the time on the news media. So how have loan modifications so far worked out?
They've given us a lot to talk about.
Okay.
Most of it not terribly positive.
Okay.
Somebody asked me if I had any positive news. I said, yes, I was positive these things weren't working. The problem with the loan modifications to date, but besides the fact that they've been entirely voluntary and therefore easy to ignore, is that they really have not made any compelling reason for the servicers to look at principal balance, write-downs, or deferrals. The servicers to date have really focused mostly on the length of the loan or on the interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Obama plan, which candidly was probably one of the better thought-out programs that we've seen so far, at least had some guidelines on percentage of income and so forth, doesn't compel the servicers to do principal balance write-downs as a big part of that, or doesn't have a component in it that sort of moderates their loss if they did the write-downs. So when you have all these properties coming due to reset that are significantly, seriously upside down, really the only way to modify them effectively is if you're willing to do a write-down on the principal balance. And we just haven't seen any appetite among the financial services industry to do that yet.
Well, in a way, does that create if they said, okay, let's do that, let's toss in the towel and let's reduce everyone's principal? What about the guy next door who doesn't get that deal? What are the ramifications of taking someone that played by all the rules and put down 50% and all of a sudden, he's also at a break-even point now. He hasn't got any equity, but his neighbor, who he knows lied through his teeth to get a loan, all of a sudden gets a $250,000 break on principal. How's that going to set? Do we have any idea if we're going to induce a lot more foreclosures by doing that?
We don't, and that's one of the popular cocktail discussions that gets bandied about. I would submit two things to you. One, I think we may be overstating the number of people that are going to find themselves in that circumstance.
Okay.
We didn't have a very high incidence of people putting 50% down on their properties through the early part of the decade. If we did, the numbers that we'd be reading about in the paper would be much lower on a day-to-day basis. We had people using ridiculously lax financing in order to get properties that they really couldn't afford. So I'm not sure how widespread the problem is to begin with. Secondly, I think it's fair game to suggest that if you're going to create a program that forgives debt for homeowners who find themselves in default and upside down, that you need a program that extends similar opportunities for people that, to your point, did play by all the rules. So maybe you don't do a principal balance write down. Maybe what you do is a long-term deferral. You take that Riverside property that sold for $500,000 and is now worth $250,000, and you put the $250,000 on a balloon payment at the end of a 30-year fixed rate loan. That would not require the lender to write down the value of the asset. It would keep a homeowner probably at a number they could afford, and at some point in the future, that amount's going to be due and payable. But hopefully at a time when the property is worth a little bit more than it is in today's market. You could also do something like equity sharing, which has been talked about, mm-hmm. which is we'll write down your principal balance, but when you sell the property, we want X percent of the proceeds. My guess is that most people that are current on their loans and can afford what they're currently paying wouldn't really want to participate in either of those options.
Okay.
But I think it's fair game to say if we're going to make it easier for people to stay in these loans that they really couldn't afford on properties that were overvalued, we ought to do something for the people who play by the rules.
The states that have non-recourse loans in place, so California being one of them, do they have a higher percentage of people that become late that ultimately turn into a bank REO just simply because there's no more financial responsibility after the foreclosure?
That's common, sort of common wisdom is that non-recourse states will typically see more properties ultimately wind up being foreclosed on, whether they go back to the banks or they're sold at a foreclosure auction. I haven't seen a comprehensive study done on that.
Okay.
At this point, and there's a lot of discussion right now about whether or not you'll start to see more loans have a recourse option as a way of perhaps mitigating lender losses as this problem is sort of spooled out of control.
The House of Representatives just passed something unanimously. It doesn't mean it's law. It's going to make its way through Senate. But this was a good one. Mandating that a lender that forecloses on a property give the former owner a 5-year lease option on the house. Have you heard of that one?
I hadn't heard the details. I knew that there was a lease option discussion in the House, but I hadn't heard they voted on it.
Yeah, they voted on it unanimously. I guess it'll march toward the Senate. I would think that would affect loan programs going forward.
I would think that'll affect so many components of the housing market going forward. You and I could probably do another 3 shows on it.
Okay.
Yeah, it really could. And you know, one of the problems that this sort of scenario, first of all, it's a valiant attempt to make sure that Mr. and Mrs. Smith and their kids don't wind up out on the street.
Yes.
And so let's sort of salute it for the intent behind it. From a logistical standpoint, most lenders are not set up to be property management companies. And there's some question about what this is going to do, frankly, to their capital structure and their accounting ledgers. How do they treat the loss on that property? How do they treat the asset value? What does it do to the loan risk profile? Is it higher risk because you're going to have more people defaulting? Is it lower risk because you're going to still see revenue? Is it something you have to charge more for as an initial loan because if you do have to give the five-year option, you're not going to be able to recoup all your losses, and on and on and on.
Yeah, so it's a mess.
It's a whole can of worms.
Moratoriums in general, which have been in place in California now for at least a second time, are they working? And I guess for what purpose are they in place?
I'm led to believe that the purpose of the moratoria was to get the word moratorium back into the English language, because we really hadn't been talking about it for a long time until now.
Okay.
We have not seen a single moratorium that has not performed just like this. There's a huge run-up of foreclosure activity before the moratorium goes into place.
Right.
There's a huge drop-off during the moratorium, and there's an explosion of foreclosure activity, usually at or above the previous levels, once the moratorium is lifted. So what they've really done in most cases, unfortunately, is just delayed the inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And the unintended consequence is that probably extended the housing downturn by pushing the problem further out. And I know, again, that wasn't the intent. But absent any program in place that says during this moratorium, all the lenders and borrowers have to get together and figure stuff out, it really doesn't accomplish what the intent of the moratorium really was.
Is it common? Now, California has had a couple of moratoriums. First of all, I guess, how many states really have a disaster on their hands? I mean, there's 50 states. Is there less than 10 that would be under the category of California?
There are probably 10 states that account for 75% of the numbers of foreclosures that you see, yeah.
Are they doing moratoriums as well?
Just about all of them have had some sort of legislative delaying process over the last 18 months, or they've changed their laws or implemented some sort of foreclosure mitigation programs, yeah.
CoreLogic came out with something in the news a couple days ago about 9% or a little bit more than 9% of California borrowers are 90 days late or more.
I saw that.
So how does that make 2010 look? I mean, it's going to eclipse 09?
That's actually a pretty good debate right now. We probably have seen whatever carnage we're going to see out of the subprime problem.
Okay.
The two big variables are when unemployment peaks, because as you know, there's usually about a 3 to 6 month lag time between unemployment and foreclosure action.
Okay.
And then how bad that'll be in the state. And then the other variable is how badly these option ARM loans will default. And I would hazard a guess that a lot of the delinquencies right now are either unemployment or there are these option ARMs. So right now, our forecast is that we may hit what amounts to a numerical peak even this year, because the raw number of option ARM loans was not as high as the raw number of subprime loans.
Okay.
But that 2010 will probably look very much like 2009 in total. We might even see the beginning of the year continue to be increased levels of foreclosure activity before it settles down toward the end of the year. So we're not looking for any big fall off next year. And if unemployment extends or if the housing market is still depreciating in terms of prices as these option arms reset, it could be worse than this year. So we might not see any stability till 2011.
All right. Well, Rick, we've run out of time. Rick, Senior Vice President of RealtyTrack, and he will be joining us at I Survive Real Estate 2009, September 11th. So, Rick, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Bruce. Looking forward to the event.
All right.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com. The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate 2009. 1M1 Properties, Dalmay Properties, Elite Auctions, the Inland Empire Investors Forum, Las Brisas Escrow, Los Angeles Event Center, the Mortgage Equity Group, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, the REO Mentor Tony Alvarez, Westin South Coast Plaza,
Women's Council of Realtors, Inland Valley Chapter. To find out more about I Survived Real Estate 2009 and how you can get involved, visit isurvived2009.com.